Before we get to the show, I want to tell you about another podcast that you're going to love, Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia. Ear Hustle brings you the daily realities of life inside prison, shared by those living it, and stories from the outside, post-incarceration. They're just wrapping up their sixth season, which covers topics like COVID-19 and San Quentin prison, parents in prison, and stories of life in the vehicles that drive people to and between prisons. You can listen and subscribe at earhustlesq.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jason Kander, and this is Majority 54, the podcast that helps Americans who voted for progress convince those who didn't to join our majority. I am very excited about our very special guest, so much so that I'm a little bit nervous. Even though she used to be on the podcast all the time, my wife, Diana, is here. Say hello.
Hello.
And I will give you a proper introduction, which is to say Diana is a very accomplished innovation consultant and speaker who specializes in helping leaders drive innovation within their organizations. She is a best-selling author. She has written twice as many books as me, which is to say she's written two. And what am I leaving out? You're mother of my children and smarter than me. She helps with this podcast. She helps us in many different ways, and now she's going to help us on air. Ravi, I'm just babbling about my wife. You should take over.
Well, Diana has been instrumental to this podcast just in the brief time I've been involved in it. So I'm really excited to bring her on board and put her on air again, because I know before I came, she used to do the ads from what I understand. And Jason and I have been hopelessly trying to keep up ever since. And reading the ads is actually the most nerve-wracking part of my week every week. So feel free to come back anytime and continue to do the ads. But in more serious news, we had an insurrection at the Capitol last week, the day we taped two episodes. And unfortunately, five people died from that incident and many more were injured. The acting U.S. attorney for D.C. has said that we now have over 70 people charged, over 170 open cases stemming from that incident, and over 100,000 digital tips that they're sorting through. And the FBI has issued warnings that they expect armed protests at potentially all 50 state capitals in the days ahead. And the big news of the day is that as we're speaking, the House is holding hearings on an article of impeachment that accuses the president of inciting the insurrection. And this article of impeachment should pass largely on party lines, but not completely on party lines. So just as background, the last impeachment, which wasn't too long ago, was completely party line vote in the House. We are expecting at least five members of the GOP House caucus to vote for impeachment, including Liz Cheney, who said that never has there been a greater betrayal by the president of the United States. And just as background before I kick it to you two, once the House votes, they have to decide if and when to send charges to the Senate. Schumer has called on McConnell to take up these articles of impeachment before the 19th, which is when the Senate was planned to come back into session, which is the day before the inauguration. And it's totally up to McConnell whether he uses emergency powers to do that. If he doesn't, then the earliest this trial could begin is on the 19th, which is the day before inauguration and the day before Democrats take control of the Senate. Jason and Diana, what do we think about the prospects of impeachment? And do we think it's the rationale makes sense?
I don't know how anybody who has either watched or read the speech that the president gave at the Stop the Steal rally, how you could observe that speech and not think that he should be impeached. And I feel that way about all the GOP leaders who have been hiding their head in the sand for the last 4 years and trying not to hear or read as much as possible. So I found an excellent long thread by Seth Abramson online that I sent to Jason. I was like, you have to read this. It's a line by line breakdown of the speech and how it incited the violence. And for anybody who thinks we should just move on and unite, they really need to read that speech.
I have been saying for the last couple of weeks, like to family and friends, that I think that they are going to impeach and remove. And everybody's been telling me that that's crazy and that prediction is wildly way out there. And maybe that'll prove to be right. But I mean, now we're seeing reports that McConnell is saying, like, let's just move on from him, which I think makes a lot of sense politically for the Republicans. It makes a lot of sense morally for the Republicans. Not that that's like a chief consideration for McConnell or a lot of people in his caucus, unfortunately, but it makes a lot of practical sense. And also, I think personally for McConnell, I think McConnell has had to deal with this guy for 4 years, and he's just like, you know, he's lost the majority leader position. I don't think he's probably going to finish his term. I assume he's going to resign at some point because he doesn't want to be minority leader. I don't know if he has it in him to put in the work of the 2 years it'll take to recruit the candidates, to raise the money, to try and take the majority back. So I don't know if he goes that long. So I think he's kind of like, screw it, I'm done. Let's impeach this guy and convict him so that it's not a black mark on me. Like, that's, maybe I'm going to be proven completely naive and idealistic in a time that's not called for. But that's what I think, Robbie. What about you?
Yeah, I urge our listeners, you know, normally I wouldn't recommend reading a House bill, but this is actually only 3 pages. And if you read it, you'll see it's a very simple case. It cites 2 different things. As Diana talked about it, it cites the president's speech that morning to his supporters, which we'll spend some more time talking about a little bit later in the pod. And then it also cites his January 2nd call to the Georgia Secretary of State, in which he urged the Secretary of State of Georgia to find enough votes to overturn that election. And I actually think that it's an even tighter case on the second one. I think they're both pretty tight, but in the second one, it's a criminal violation in addition to, you know, a breach of the high crimes and misdemeanors, right? Like, and I think there's also Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which says that elected officials in the United States can't be engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States, right? And I think that, I think Trump is guilty on both counts. I think it's so obvious on the Georgia stuff that he was trying to break the law and find votes, like almost like an old school Chicago politician. You know, I can't see how the GOP, I'm with Diane, I can't see how members of the GOP can say that they're for the rule of law and not vote for this impeachment.
I also think that there's an element here, right or wrong, of they felt afraid for their lives and they're pissed. Ultimately, I feel like the tiebreaker here is the fact that he didn't have these people go tear down the Washington Monument, or I'm not suggesting he should have done any of these things, like, but it, I think it would have been a very different situation if he had had these people go and harm somebody else in some other place. It would have been just as horrible, just as morally reprehensible, and clearly would not have gotten the same reaction from members of the GOP, because the fact is, like, these people felt like, and they were right, that their lives were at risk, and the president did that. And that, I think that may be a difference here.
I'm going to counterpoint.
Okay. That's
as we do in our
for.
House, and say the reason they're not going to vote for it is because they're afraid for their lives now. And if you saw the video of how Lindsey Graham was treated on his return at the airport, I'm scared on their behalf. And that's a really, you know, scary situation when they're thinking about their own lives and their families on how to take a vote.
This is perhaps the most important discussion, not just of this week, but moving forward, is we've entered a new phase in this polarization, as we call it, which seems too quaint a word at this point to describe what's happening in this country. And obviously, depending on where you live and who you are, threats of violence have been more of a mainstay in your life than just the past few weeks. But I think this was the first time in our country that violence has made its way in this, you know, in this kind of way to the halls of government. And I was left thinking to myself that this mission of this pod, which is still important and one that I still believe in, is not sufficient. Like, there are these conversations now, like, what do you do when your safety is threatened? Not just when somebody uses words that you disagree with. These are like things that we need to think about more and more over time. And, you know, merely anchoring a good conversation in the same, in shared values, isn't going to get you out of a situation where somebody's trying to throw you down steps and drag you to your death. And so I was left considering solutions, options, infrastructure that I hadn't been thinking about before. What about you two?
I think you're totally right. I was thinking this week, you know, like, how do you make conversation with somebody who's been radicalized? At that point, now we're talking about like using cult framework to try to cleanse somebody from all the propaganda that has infiltrated their brains. And cults are one of my favorite subjects. I love to study them. But like at this point with some people and because there has been such a huge platform to radicalize more and more people with propaganda, some people are very difficult to have rational conversations with. You have to make a different tactic of how to get them out of that place and out of that mindset.
It's a conversation that is increasingly being had in the veteran community because so many of us are so upset to see how many, you know, veterans were a part of the mob that stormed the Capitol. And what it's made me think about is I have no idea whether veterans are more susceptible to this sort of radicalization or not, or if it just feels that way because every time one is involved, it makes the news. I don't know, but I do know that anybody whose life has changed in such a way that they feel isolated and no longer have a sense of belonging, which is what happens to a lot of us when we leave the service, whether you went overseas or not, I do know that that makes you more susceptible to falling in with the group of people who you might not otherwise fall in with. If, you know, if you're given a sense of purpose and belonging, even if it's one that, you know, in your right mind, you would not have fallen in for. And so, yeah, I think you're right that it is about whatever the usual tactics are, if they're more like intervention type tactics to try and remove people from falling in with a cult, like that's part of what we need to learn about. But I also think that for the people listening, their most immediate responsibility is to focus on the hope and the idealism of those of us who are like-minded, which is the vast majority of the country. I mean, not just like the people who voted for progress in the last election. I mean, the vast majority of the country is like, it is not okay to try to overthrow the government, right? Like the overwhelming majority. And the people in that category, we are feeling right now like we're not the overwhelming majority. And I think it's really important to remind each other that it doesn't have to go this direction and we're not outnumbered by these people. And so I think focusing on that and injecting hope and idealism into the rest of us. And I think it reminds me of another reason why I think it's so important that impeachment and removal occur, which is that going forward, I saw somebody say this online and I thought it was brilliant. Going forward, I want our kids, when they study American history, I want them to ask the teacher, wait, why was Mike Pence president for 2 days? Because I want our kids to learn about fascism and I want them to learn about what can happen and how fragile democracy is.
One thing, though, that worries me is, you know, I hadn't really thought in a little while about just what happens when our government is overwhelmed by people using a militia carve out in the Constitution to then take up arms against the government and like an egregious misreading of our history. What do we do in that situation is the sort of big question I've been asking myself, you know?
I think that it's another reason why it's so important to lay down this historical marker of impeachment and conviction. But if that doesn't happen, now, this is not what we as regular citizens do, but I think as far as the incoming Justice Department, which this has already started because, you know, the FBI and the lower levels of the Justice Department have already started it. The arrests and the prosecutions and the convictions for sedition are vital, including if that evidence leads to conspiracies that involved members of Congress, that chain of evidence has to be pursued. And if the case is there, the prosecution has to be made. And maybe that sounds like a no-brainer, but there is a natural instinct here to say, we don't want to go in what could seem like a banana republic direction. We don't want to have the administration change. And then you have prosecutions of people who didn't vote the way that things went. No, this is not that. This is different. The people out there who have these arsenals and think that this is a logical extension of American politics need to understand that you'll go to prison and you'll go for a really long time, because it's pretty clear that the people who stormed the Capitol, I get no indication that they thought that they were sort of martyrs for the cause who were going to do this. And then, yeah, okay, I'll spend many years in prison, but it's worth it. I don't think that they thought that was going to happen at all, because it's reasonable with Trump in office. And if you believe you're going to keep him in office, to think that'll never happen. And so I think part of this is making sure those people understand, like, no, you'll go to prison because it makes you an enemy of the United States and you'll be treated as such.
So I was born in the Soviet Union and not Russia, but the Soviet Union. I was born in the Ukraine, but it was all part of one place. They kind of just took over. But I will tell you that not all human beings want to live in a democracy, and not all bad guys wear a dictator lapel pin. A lot of them hide in democratic ideals. So currently, Russia is a democracy. And
in air quotes for the audio audience.
Yes. And the people who are in charge really like it the way that it is. And so I just think a lot of people take for granted how many other people are along with them. Like, I think that's the confirmation bias on our side, that we just assume everybody wants to live in a democracy because we haven't asked them.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because for those listening, a little more of the story, Diana escaped the Soviet Union as a refugee of religious persecution at the age of 7 and came to the United States. And so in the run-up to this election, you kept saying to me that you were really worried about this happening.
I said it 4 years ago. I said, I'm worried this is the last election we're ever going to have. And Jason was like, that's ridiculous. And I was like, I don't know, I've seen it.
Yeah, I'll admit, like, I was, I don't know that I said that's ridiculous, because I love you and I don't speak to you that way.
It's your show. Sure, sure.
Anyway, I may have said that's ridiculous, but I'm sure I said it in a more loving tone.
Of course.
But I was very, you know, I was very skeptical of all that. And I was sort of, I thought it was inflammatory. I wasn't saying this time around, I was not saying, no, there's no way there'll be violence. But clearly, like, this was less of a surprise to you than it was to me. And I do think that has a lot to do with having escaped a place like that.
Out of all the people that we knew, I don't want to keep harping on this, but I was the first one to say Donald Trump's going to win from the moment he announced his candidacy, because I come from a country where people love a strong man, like a person to get behind, and they want to be behind a winner. And I just saw the way that he was speaking and people were reacting to him.
It's more widespread than you think. Like, I've had more conversations with people over the course of the past week, or overheard them, where people are talking about joining militias. People are spinning all kinds of conspiracy theories about what happened at the Capitol, which we'll talk about in a little bit. You know, and even my dad, and, you know, I recorded a podcast with my dad a couple of years ago at the beginning of the Trump presidency, and he did it on air, so he would be comfortable with me sharing this, is I asked him, when Trump mentions that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and his supporters would continue to support him, are you one of those supporters? And he said yes. And then I was texting with him this week about what happened, and I won't share the content too much, but needless to say, we have a different belief about this country. And I think I lost it with him, and I don't know when I'll come out the other side of it. It's just that I think we're at a different stage now with certain people. I wouldn't say all people who are conservatives or Republicans, but there is a segment, and it's bigger than I'd be comfortable with, of people who hold views that are dangerous. Now, I don't mean dangerous like the way, like, people say, like, you know, like, this idea could lead to that idea, which maybe eventually could lead to some society I don't want, like the conversation we had with Yuri. I mean, like, dangerous, like if somebody came to arrest me tomorrow, you know, in Trump's FBI under some trumped up political charge, I don't think my dad would support me. And that's the kind of country that we live in. And maybe he would support me because I'm his son, but if it were my friend, you know, and I don't even know if he'd support me because I'm his son, but he certainly wouldn't support somebody who would be my colleague at work just because they're my colleague at work. And that's a dangerous place to be as a country, you know?
It's also just really sad, Robbie, and I'm sorry.
Yeah. You know, and I mentioned this because I don't want our audience to think that we're just these jolly people who are like, just keep having the conversation. Like, I'm done. I told my dad, I told him very seriously, I don't want to speak to him anymore. And I meant it and I mean it. And I don't see myself changing my mind unless he decides to leave the cult. You know, there was a person there at one point who I really admired, and that person is gone. There's this book by Lawrence Wright about Scientology, about how people dealt with family members who joined Scientology. And basically, you just kind of have to wait. Like, you have to wait for them to leave on their own terms, you know, and that's kind of how I see it right now. And it could be forever, but I'm not speaking to a person who's rational when I'm dealing with my father. He's not my brother. He's not other people I know who may have voted one way or another. Like, he believes every single thing that this president says. And if the president says, go chop somebody's head off and a bunch of people do it, my dad's going to find a justification for that.
Yeah, no, there's no responsibility to try and bring back people who are that far gone. I think for the people listening, that if anything, the opportunity is to try to prevent people from being radicalized. And part of that is by making sure that we frame all this as separate from, like, traditional American political discourses. We can't
Ravi, I'm not trying to argue with you about your decision, but as somebody who studies cults as a hobby, like I watch every documentary on every cult. This is one of my favorite topics. One of the reasons that people stay in cults for so long is because like part of it is to isolate yourself from the people that you love. And so they feel like they have no connection to the outside world. And so they have to stay in this group that they've committed themselves to, even though it feels weird. So I'm not challenging you or pushing you. I'm just giving you a counterpoint to say we have to be a lifeline. Like you don't have to agree with him, but just still love somebody in an unconditional way and just say, I love you and I'm here whenever you want to talk about not that, but just to be their path back. If they don't have that, then they'll just stay forever.
Or you don't have to offer to talk to them if you don't want to. It could just be, I love you. And when you are ready to stop doing this, I'm here.
Like, Yeah, I've just run out of energy, to be honest. And
I think.
I totally hear you. And I think, obviously, you know, our listeners have heard me talk enough about this. There's more layers to that relationship. And, you know, there's something I said a few podcasts back that I've been reminding myself of this week, which is sometimes it's not about the thing. Like sometimes you freak out at your spouse, not because they didn't pick up their laundry, but because something else pissed you off about it. And I'm trying to untangle the complicated psychology of it all, which is something I've advised our audience of when I was in my sober, unemotional state where I was advising them. Whereas now I'm blinded by rage. Like it's now a week later and I'm no less angry. I'm not getting sleep about this. And I think about our country and I'm just so sad because I view it as our shared experience. I think about my brother and my dad and all of us at 4th of July parades together and waving the same flag together. And, you know, what used to be a cute, cool, you know, Carville Matlin debate has now descended into an existential debate that about our safety and about foundational principles. And it's overwhelming, you know?
No, man, it's heartbreaking. You shared some of the texts with me and like for me, my perspective, I didn't even really think about it from your perspective so much as I thought about it from his, because I'm a dad and I thought I can't understand it. I can't ever envision disagreeing with my son about anything so much that I'd be willing to sacrifice the relationship. Even if I like, he's wrong, but like, even if he were right, like if true kills people and is on death row, like I'm going to go visit him and tell him I love him. I don't even understand, which I don't think he's going to do that. But so I couldn't see it from his perspective. So I get it, man. I mean, I don't get it, but it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the words and audience. Thank you for hearing me out on this. I didn't go here in the past couple of weeks, but it's obviously something relevant. So I'm sharing it. But, you know, if we brought my other family member here, Yuri, he would be focusing his attention if I can channel him on the social media bans. And I would suspect, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, but either he or people who have his sort of strain of conservatism are highly suspicious of big tech companies and their power. And we were met this week with news that Twitter is banning Trump indefinitely, and that Amazon, Apple, a bunch of other companies have purged a host of different accounts and sites, including Parler, which is a kind of Twitter clone that is both financed by right-wing funders like Rebecca Mercer and populated by members of the right wing. There's a lot of contours to this. I'm not going to go through all the details of it all, but what do we think about this? Is this the right move? Are we worried about any unintended consequences? Is there even an alternative to what's happening here?
I have two contradictory positions, so I'd like to argue with myself on your podcast.
You're really good at this. Diana, by the way, this is a good time to mention that I forgot to plug at the beginning. Diana has her own podcast, Professional AF, which is really good, which is evidenced by what a good podcast guest you are.
I just argue with myself. Okay, point number one, I'm totally in favor of banning any kind of rhetoric that incites violence or organizes violent overthrows of our government. I strongly believe that.
That it seems like a reasonable position to me.
Yeah.
I agree with that, yeah.
Argument number two, I would say welcome to our conservative friends who for a long time, I believe, are under some mistaken belief that if the government is not a strong form of government, that people will be dancing free in the streets. And that is not what's going to happen. Either the government makes decisions about our lives, or corporations make decisions about our lives. And I would like to welcome them to the good fight against corporations being in power. And if you really want to understand this point of view, the way I did is through a book called Jennifer Government by Max Berry. He's my favorite author. He's not a political author, but it is the answer to Ayn Rand's novel, where he creates a future where the government is so weak that everything is run by corporations and they hire people to murder others, like for marketing benefit. I mean, they're 100% in charge. And I welcome people into the fight to prevent them from deciding the air that we breathe and the water that we drink and what we read on the internet.
Those were both great arguments. I'm not sure they're contradictory.
Well, on the one hand, I'm 100% for banning that kind of language. And on the other hand, I do disagree. You know, I don't want corporations to have unfettered control over our lives.
So there's no question in my mind that Jack Dorsey's decision to ban Trump from Twitter, at least over this last several days, saved people's lives. I just do not doubt it at all. And yeah, that much I know.
I share Diana's sort of bundle of contradictions in the sense that I think that any speech, and this is both the legal standard if this were the government banning speech, but these are obviously private companies that, barring a certain circumstance that I'll talk about in a second, can do whatever the heck they want in terms of who can be on their platform or not. And they've had no greater defenders than the GOP for that. Look at certain cases like the Bakers who didn't want to serve same-sex couples, for example, right? Like the biggest defenders of private enterprises' ability to make decisions, even if they're totally arbitrary, have been the members of the GOP. And we have a pretty like strict First Amendment culture, not even just law here in this country, that kind of goes, like, I think, head to head with what I just said. And I think if there's something that's inciting violence directly or can reasonably be seen to incite violence in the near term, then I think absolutely companies should be taking that down. I think anything beyond that, I start to get a little bit skeptical. They could do it. It's just a question of, do I think it's right if they do it or not? And I think certain things like YouTube, for instance, announcing that it was taking down all videos, if I read this correctly, that question the outcome of the election, then I start getting a little bit skeptical, especially if you believe that these companies have a monopoly. If they don't have a monopoly, no big deal. Then people take their business elsewhere. It's neither here nor there. But if it's not speech that directly incites violence, and we could debate whether that stuff does or it doesn't, but I think questioning the outcome of an election is the kind of thing we should be really careful to protect in our First Amendment, even if it's insane, the logic of it.
What is, I think, an interesting part of this is that clearly, I think in the immediate moment, I do think that given like the sort of internal revolt among employees at Twitter that started this, I think that this was basically a moral choice, right? I mean, this was a very rare thing, which was a corporation deciding that it didn't want to be morally responsible for the events that could come during this period. But in the long run, I think that these choices are made because they don't want to be legally responsible. Look, I think there's going to be, for instance, civil suits, which will have a lot of merit against Donald Trump when he leaves office, having to do with the deaths at the Capitol. And I think that there are legal arguments to be made that you could bring those against the very same companies that we're talking about. And so what is a weird twist in this is that the way, I guess, that ultimately the Republicans get around that, I guess, is to do what they try to do with all other corporate immunity, is to try to, they could try to craft laws that say you cannot be sued for stuff that's on your platform that you didn't write, which I think would be wrong. I think that that
they
would
want
not
the
be,
opposite. Right. They want the opposite. Hawley's been trying to get rid of Section 230, which basically does the opposite. And so there's actually no position here. Hawley, up until this point, wanted Parler, for example, to be totally liable for any violence that people coordinate on their platform. And I'd be interested to see what he comes out saying now. So he both believes that Parler should be liable for what happens on his platform, and then by extension, like anybody who works with Parler, like AWS. But then AWS can't kick Parler off if they think that Parler is being violent. That's like an incoherent position, right?
That's my point. It makes no sense to say that you are liable but you are prohibited from doing anything to limit your own liability.
Oh, I see. Yeah, so here's what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, for sure. Yeah. Well, I'm interested to see what the distinguished senator from Missouri has to say in the days ahead about this.
I know he's an avid listener. And the last part of this that I think adds to the hypocrisy of it is that this is the only way in which they think that these companies should be limited in their power, right? Like if you talk to them about any of the economics of being the big tech companies, you know, it is exclusively that they don't like that they have accumulated power electorally, when never mind the fact that they liked it fine when it got Donald Trump elected president.
I feel like that's the philosophy of the other side. Like, wait, this impacts me now. Right. I am concerned.
Yeah, not, oh, wait, this is violent. It's, oh, wait, it impacts us now, what you're doing. You know, not this stops violence. It's, oh, but the violence is being perpetrated by people who tend to vote for us.
Yeah. And there's something else going on here, which is also like this addiction to victimhood. You know, there's the people who are just straight up supportive of the Capitol insurrection. And then there are other people who will like the Rubios of the world, who will give lip service to the, yes, I condemn it. And then they'll quickly pivot to that. Like, we're the victims now. We need to be careful about this or that. Like, what about BLM? What about Antifa, et cetera? You know?
Can I add to victimhood the fact that nothing is their responsibility? So all of the people calling for unity are not actually themselves calling for unity. They're calling on Democrats to call for unity. Yeah. And, yeah, like, they have nothing to do. It's always, like, you're the parent. You fix it.
Right. Yeah.
We're just going to keep causing trouble.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, you know what exactly unify this country is? Like, accepting the free and fair election that we just had. Right? That would be very unifying for this country. Given the fact that I haven't been in the country, but I'm also a huge Buffalo Bills fan, I needed to figure out a way to watch the game this weekend. And I actually turned to our good friends at ExpressVPN, and I VPN'd into my cable provider and was able to watch the greatest football team in history defeat the Indianapolis Colts. And, you know, that's only possible because of ExpressVPN. And there's so many uses for it. These internet service providers, they can operate like monopolies in the regions that they serve, and they use it to take advantage of customers. They have data caps, streaming throttles, the list goes on. But worst of all, they can log your internet activity and sell your data and give it to big tech companies. To prevent them from doing that and from seeing your activity, we use ExpressVPN.
So what is ExpressVPN? It's a simple app for your computer or your smartphone that encrypts all your network data and tunnels it through a secure VPN server so that your ISP cannot see any of your activity.
It's like a big bouncer that walks with you on the internet. And like anytime bad guys come up, they're like, no, don't bother over here. This is protected.
You're good at this. So stop handing over your personal data to ISPs and other tech giants who mine your activity and sell off your information. Protect yourself with the VPN that we trust to keep us private online. Visit expressvpn.com/majority54. That's expressvpn.com/majority54 to get 3 extra months free. Go to expressvpn.com/majority54 right now to learn more.
On this episode, I talk about how anxious I've been over the past week, as I imagine many of our listeners have been. And I've turned to our friends at Headspace. You know, it's our daily dose of mindfulness, and they have guided meditations and an easy-to-use app.
Headspace is one of the only meditation apps advancing the field of mindfulness and meditation through clinically validated research. So whatever the situation, Headspace really can help you feel better. Overwhelmed? Headspace has a 3-minute SOS meditation for you. Need some help falling asleep? Headspace has wind down sessions. I use those all the time.
Can I jump in here and be like, done it?
Yeah. We're big fans in this house. Have been for a long time.
Not all of us are yogis who can just sit in silence for an hour. Some of us need somebody to hold our hand through it. And that's why Headspace, I mean, I've been doing it for years and I clearly haven't graduated from it. It's amazing.
Yeah, same. Headspace is backed by 25 published studies on its benefits, 600,000 5-star reviews, and over 60 million downloads. Headspace makes it easy for you to build a life-changing meditation practice with mindfulness that works for you on your schedule anytime. You deserve to feel happier, and Headspace is meditation made simple. Go to headspace.com/M54. That's headspace.com/M54 for a free 1 month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation. This is the best deal offered right now. Head to headspace.com/M54 today.
It's a good deal.
Let's go to our quarantine corner. What's happening in your lives?
I'll go first. I am, and this is going to sound like a weird flex type humble brag, but Ravi, I think you'll understand what I mean. I am trying to get myself to work out less because I've been starting to just hurt, and I think I've been overtraining. Diana tells me that it's because I'm turning 40 in a few months, and I need to like come to sort of terms with the fact that maybe I can't do the same things. I think that's just silly talk. That can't be it. So I'm just seeing if I can cut down to like 3 or 4 days a week in the gym.
It's not a humble brag. You're getting older and things hurt.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
What about you, Diana?
You know, my professional job is to travel and speak and meet people. And I have had gone a year without doing that. And it's been really, I guess, isolating. And I didn't know how much I missed it. And I have been venturing out on LinkedIn and reconnecting with people that I used to work with. And it feels like, for me personally, the isolation part of the pandemic is like almost non-existent because I'm connecting with so many people on the LinkedIn platform. And that's been an incredible outlet for me.
You're also producing like a lot more content now for social, and you're interacting with a lot more people that way too.
But like that kind of interaction is making up for everything that I used to get at going to events and traveling. And I've just been so surprised on my own how much it's made up for it.
Nice. That's awesome. I haven't talked about what I've been up to for a little while, partially because I left the country right after the election and was only planning to leave for a week or two. But two things happened. One was COVID got a lot worse back home, and it didn't seem reasonable to fly if I could hang out here. And here is Costa Rica. And the other part is Costa Rica is pretty cool, and it's like not a bad place to work remotely. But I refrained from talking about it just because, you know, COVID got a lot worse, and it seemed weird to be talking about surfing and all that. But I figure this is where I am, and a lot of our listeners follow me on Instagram anyway, and I, you know, we'll tweet about it and stuff like that. And I'll just give a surfing status update, which is I've gotten a lot better and a lot more confident out in the water. I had this period of time where I was like flying, making all kinds of improvement. And then the past 2 weeks happened where I've just gotten in a bit of a rut. And this morning was so bad. The waves got so big and they're so fast here that I broke a fin over my knee and almost lost my board while I was out there. And so the last time I checked in, I was dealing with my fear of drowning. And then there was this long, confident period of which I promise you listeners, I was really not as afraid. And now I'm afraid again. And so I'm just reporting back that I'm exactly where I was last time. So, I mean, I have a lot more skill for sure, but my psychology hasn't changed as it relates to waves. They're very scary.
Well, I will again check in on the pro you not drowning side, because honestly, like, I'm not sure that I keep the podcast going if I, you know, and also like we're friends.
Let's talk about this week in misinformation. And what I want to talk about is something I've heard a lot from people in my life, which is this thing going around the internet that Antifa somehow was responsible for the Capitol insurrection. And I could already channel Jason, which is Jason will inevitably say, the people who believe that, don't worry, you're not going to be able to convince them otherwise. Absolutely. But this is for the situations when other people are likely to be listening, whether it's like a Facebook post that other people who aren't as informed could be persuaded by, or you're at some kind of dinner table where other family members who are on the fence could hear this. So I just want to give you a little bit of ammo on this and then talk about like what's happening here, why this is even something that we have to respond to. There's one variant of this, which is the Washington Times reported that a facial recognition company had identified Antifa members in the Capitol when they looked through the footage. Then that company came out with a statement and said, no, actually they were Nazis. They weren't Antifa. And then the Washington Times had to retract its story. In addition to that, the FBI has come out and said that there's no indication that there are any members of Antifa who were there. But I can say this for sure. If there was even one person who was Antifa who was there, believe me, the right will find that person and they will try to lead everybody to believe that that was the entire crowd. And even if they weren't there, there was no Antifa person there, they will invent that person because that's basically what they're doing right now, because they cannot accept the fact that Trump incited this mob and that it was Trump supporters and members of the right wing who did this. That's what I think the story here is that they just cannot, to what Diana said, bear any responsibility for their words and their actions. That's my take. What do you two think?
I feel like this is a red herring. I don't even want to talk about this because we should be, when somebody says that to me, I'm like, okay, just agree. Anybody who is in the Capitol should be arrested and jailed. Like, I don't care if they were part of the Blue Man Group, they should be in jail. I think that insurrection should be illegal. And I think that this is like part of the whataboutism and part of the tricks that people use to keep us from actually trying to solve problems.
So, Ravi, this is an occasion where I actually was not going to say you got to ignore those people, because I feel like we can't allow this to get any roots, because it'll grow, right? It'll grow into a piece of this is like if we didn't take seriously the 9/11 truther stuff and like try and counter it every, you know, because when people were doing that, like serious people were like, no, that's bullshit, we're not going to go for that, and they would really stamp it out. This to me is the same. It's a historical event, not unlike 9/11, and you can't allow this to be an acceptable alternative, you know, revisionist history of this. And so as a result, like, I think if you hear it, you have to really strongly challenge it. And to me, the strongest way to challenge it is, let me get this straight. You're saying that people on our side of things showed up to try to stop the certification of an election that we won.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Like, an insurrection against a government that was changing to away from the people that Antifa, you know, that group, I mean, they're literally called anti-fascists. Like, you don't have to be okay with any of their tactics, which, you know, I don't know anybody in Antifa. I don't think it's an organized thing. I have no idea. But like, if I did, I'd be like, no, that's not okay. I would like turn them into the FBI if they had gone and done violent things. But again, like, anti-fascism is not like, let's have an insurrection in order to install fascists.
Yeah, I think what they're saying is it's a false flag operation. And so it's insane. I know, and I'm with Diana.
Well, then let's debate that. Yeah. Like, how would you do that?
Here's what I recommend to the audience. Is like, I often don't recommend people commit things to memory or anything like that, because you can't litigate every fact that exists because it's just tedious. This is one historical event that I recommend people actually deeply understand, because it will come up for the rest of your life. And I want to start where we started this pod, which is, as you both recommended, read the speech that the president gave and understand this. And then I'll paint to you the kind of, like, this is how you can make somebody look a little silly who makes these claims. So on December 19th, 17th, January 1st, and January 3rd, the president promoted on Twitter this rally, right? So he's asking his supporters to go, and he wanted them to come challenge the results. Then the night before, he tweeted a threat, basically. He says, I hope Democrats and the weak and ineffective rhinos are looking to the thousands of people pouring into D.C. They won't stand for a landslide election to be stormed. So you have to also believe that the president asked these people to come. Then the night before is like giddy about them coming, but is misunderstood that he's now asked a bunch of Antifa false flag people, not his own supporters, to come. Then on the day, he gives a speech to them, which we've now covered well, where he basically incites them to violence, and then asks them to go down to the Capitol. Then they storm the Capitol in all of his gear. And then we've now arrested a bunch of them, and they have very confirmed conservative and very right-wing views. And then afterwards, the president tweets, we love you, you're very special, remember this day forever. So the president has been misunderstood every step of the way, that he's been asking his own supporters to come to the Capitol. He asked them to go to the Capitol at his rally. We arrest them, they're confirmed right-wingers. And then afterwards, he praises them, and he's just that dumb that he doesn't know that he's just been speaking to a whole group of Antifa people, and only Antifa people, this whole time. That's what you have to believe.
It's the ultimate boogeyman, right? Because it's a perfect target, right? Because like I said, none of us know anybody who's Antifa, and people who are Antifa, like, they cover their faces, they hide their identity. So it is a perfect straw man for them to consistently put out there and say, well, they were there, because nobody knows who they are in most cases anyway.
Look, nobody who overthrows a government, again, I come from a place where they do it all the time. Nobody who overthrows a government does like, we're going to make lives worse for everybody. They're fighting a bad guy and they need to create this persona where they can tell you who the bad guys are. They can't use the Democrats because it's very easy to see what a Democrat is, right? They can name Antifa. Nobody can say, no, we're not Antifa. Like, nobody can disown it because it's not a thing. And so it's a great nemesis for organizing their people. During COVID, the amount of domestic violence has increased sharply. And in this time of divisiveness and encouraged violence, domestic violence is continuing to go up. So Jason and I have been big supporters of a local domestic violence shelter called New House. There's a local shelter wherever you live. If you want to support ours, it's newhousekc.org. But they need resources now more than ever so that women and children have a safe place to stay.
All right. Also, a great way to support the show and share the Majority 54 love is to purchase one of the Gravenor shirts, which you can get at wondermedianetwork.com/bonfire. Remember, you can leave us a voicemail. Let us know what you're contending with and what you'd like help responding to. That voicemail again is 508-687-2589, 508-687-2589. I'm going to one more time tell people that Diana has her own podcast. It's called Professional AF. It's very, very good. You can get it wherever you listen to this podcast.
Not political.
Oh, and it is.
Let's just do
not,
that warning.
It's not political, yeah. You want to describe it?
No.
Okay. You'll just have to go and find out. I'm at Jason Kander on Instagram and Twitter. Diana is at Diana Kander on Instagram and Twitter. And are there others?
LinkedIn.
And LinkedIn. Okay. Ravi is at Ravi M. Gupta on Twitter and Instagram. Our show is at Majority 54 on Twitter. Remember, we all have a platform. Make sure to use yours today.
Majority 54 is a Wonder Media Network production. It's produced by Grace Lynch and Edie Allard. Theme music provided by Kenneth Coleman. Special thanks, of course, to Diana Kander. And also thanks to Rydon Nosar for the free space for recording.